This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Eamon Ormseth, your host for this week's episode. In part three of our series on the Israel lobby, we'll continue our discussion of AIPAC that began last week by delving into how it uses campaign donations, and more recently, a political action committee, to steer U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East in a pro-Israel direction. Today's guest is Michael J. Rosenberg. MJ is a writer and commentator on the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, and U.S. and Israeli politics. Rosenberg worked for AIPAC from 1982 to 1986 and wrote the group's weekly newsletter, Near East Report. Prior to this, he worked on Capitol Hill for over 15 years for various Democratic members of the House and Senate. From 1998 to 2009, he was director of policy at the Israel Policy Forum. And from 2009 to 2012, Rosenberg worked for Media Matters for America. MJ currently writes a Substack newsletter at www.mjx847.substack.com. MJ, welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine.
Thank you, Eamon.
So, MJ, I just recounted some of your career trajectory. You went from working for AIPAC and working for members of Congress on the Hill to becoming a critic of AIPAC. Can you recount some of the highlights of this trajectory for our listeners?
Well, it's not just a critic of AIPAC, but of Israel itself. I mean, it's the two go together. I'm fond of explaining, my shorthand way of explaining my conversion on AIPAC first and then Israel with the beloved phrase, I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. I only worked at AIPAC from 76 to 82, but I changed my views after the 2000 Camp David summit, where I felt that then Prime Minister Ehud Barak totally chickened out and terminated the negotiations. In fact, got our president, Bill Clinton, to say, he asked, if I can't do this, will you promise to blame the Palestinians and not me? In fact, you can read a book, there's a whole book about that episode called The Truth About Camp David by Clayton Swisher, which tells exactly how and how that was done. So anyway, after 2000, I didn't start having doubts. I just kind of woke up. My experiences at AIPAC, combined with my 15 to 20 years in both Capitol Hill and State Department, USAID, in which I could see AIPAC's heavy hand on everything. I mean, AIPAC's essential control of U.S. Middle East policy. I saw some of the things going on at AIPAC, but it was just as bad, if not worse, when I was working on Capitol Hill. And I saw, as a congressional aide in the House and Senate, how they exerted their influence. Just one example. I work for the House Appropriations Committee. The Appropriations Committee provides all the money for the government, including all the foreign aid money. Israel gets $3 to $4 billion a year. As a staffer for a member of the committee, we staffers, working with our bosses, but mainly the staffers, put together the sections of the appropriations bill that our bosses were interested in. So if your boss was most interested in women's issues, you'd put the money in for those issues. So you sort of like pick the sections that you most want to get in into the bill, into the final bill, and to get funded by the United States government. The Israel aid, the Middle East section, all the Israel aid money, the language that we send over to the chairman, and that is every member of the committee sent over, was produced in AIPAC's office, sent to us by email, and then we just dittoed it and sent it to the chairman of the committee. That's how it worked. We didn't change anything. We didn't do anything. They wrote the entire aid section about Israel, including such things of how the money would be dispersed. They always wanted it to be dispersed for earliest in the year, so that, unlike anything else in the budget, I forgot what the date was. They'd have it dispersed on such and such a day. So unlike, let's say, HHS or anything in the United States, which would have to wait till, let's say, October to get the money, Israel, we get the money on January 1st. They are all powerful on everything related to Israel up there. It was worth seeing it as a staffer because you see their arrogance, you know, marching in and demanding to see your member or your senator. I worked for Carl Levin of Michigan. They'd come marching in, making their demands as if they were the boss, which they were. But not so good of him. He was a good guy. That's my history with them.
So thank you for that anecdote. What would have happened if your boss at the time, maybe Carl Levin, or the bosses of some of your other colleagues working for other offices had said no? Because certainly, as you said, it's kind of arrogant to march into someone's office and say, this is the language that you're going to put in the bill. There's some power in that, as you said. So what would have happened if a member of Congress said no? We're not going to sign off on this language.
Well, I can tell you, and this happened in when I was working for Carl Levin. It is a long time ago, 1988, but it's worse now, and this is bad enough. The Prime Minister of Israel, whose name was Yitzhak Shamir, announced that the United Nations Resolution 242 and 338, which calls for Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories, he said that language does not apply to Israel anymore. So Carl Levin called me into his office and said, write me up a short letter to Shamir telling him that you may think that 242 and 338 don't apply to the United States, but the United States thinks it applies. And it was written in very soft language. I mean, everything, Carl made it so there was nothing in it that was offensive. It was just saying, this is the policy of the United States. Actually, we didn't write it. We didn't write it to Shamir. We wrote it to our Secretary of State, George Shultz, and he was Reagan's Secretary of State. So we wrote it, and then Carl said, you know, maybe I should get some other senators to sign it. So he went down to the Senate floor, and he got 30 senators instantly, and he said, okay, I'll stop there. We got to get this thing to Shultz. We let Shultz know it was coming, so because we knew he'd welcome it. So I went over there to the State Department to hand it to his people. It wasn't that big a deal. We didn't know what would happen. We didn't expect really anything to happen. It was a private letter. It wasn't a public letter. Private as it can be when you have 30 senators sign it, which of course means that's not that private really. That was on a Friday. It was the lead story in the New York Times on Sunday. It was March 30th, 1988. The headline was like, 30 U.S. senators criticize Israel, blah, blah, blah. Really the lead story. In fact, if you want to ever look it up, just call it, quote, Letter of 30, Levin. AIPAC contacted his top donors. The phone rang off the hook incessantly. My worst moment during it was pretty scary. I mean, I got a call from the New York Times columnist, William Sapphire, who was an AIPAC guy, but their top foreign policy writer. He threatened me on the phone. He said, I know that you wrote that letter. I was just a staffer. You wrote the letter, that you did it at the behest of leftists in Israel. You didn't write it. You didn't write it. They handed it to you. You gave it to Carl because you're a leftist. And Carl distributed it. I was like horrified. He was such a famous guy.
Let me add something there. You've argued that AIPAC should be registered as an agent of a foreign government.
Yeah.
In this instance, the New York Times foreign policy columnist accused you of inserting language from Israeli leftists into this letter. Now, you made the argument, and correct me if I'm misquoting you, that AIPAC essentially takes its foreign policy's priorities from the Likud party in Israel, or at least closely coordinates, if not parrots, the foreign policy objectives of the Likud party.
If it's in power. Right. Well, that's an irony I pointed out to Sapphire at the time. It's really ironic. AIPAC is an unregistered lobby for the state of Israel, for the government of Israel. I, however, am not, obviously. So I said, when he said, you didn't write it, I said, you want to come over? You can come over and look at my computer. I'll show you all the versions. It's all on my computer, and then I have handwritten versions. I'm not interested in seeing all of that. In my column next week, I am going to write that you're an agent, honest to goodness, really, you're an agent of the Israeli left or the Labor Party or something. I don't know what the word was used. And I said, you know, accusing me of being an agent of a foreign government could cost me my job. I have security clearances. I have sworn an oath of allegiance to the United States to get this job. And you're accusing me of it? The irony is insane. It turned out I was so upset. In fact, I even said, you're gonna write this. My kid's bar mitzvah is Saturday. Thanks. This would be really just what, you know, he said. Then he said something like, well, I may not say it directly, but then he said, Mr. Rosenberg, I hope you are telling the truth. Because if you're not, whether it's now or 5 years or 10 years, I'll destroy your career. He said that point blank. Well, he wrote the column. It was kind of weak because the part that he was going to, it still attacked Levin, yeah, but didn't mention me at all. I mean, he could see by my vehemence, I guess, that, that I wasn't, and maybe he thought I was actually telling the truth. Yeah. I subsequently heard that this whole story about me personally came from, he got it directly from Israel's UN ambassador to the United States. So in New York, just like Sapphire was in New York, the UN, Israel's UN ambassador was in New York, and his name then was Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh, can I stop you for another second? So I want to read a quote from an article you wrote 12 years ago when you resigned from Media Matters. So you wrote, quote, the serious enforcers who suppress any criticism of Israeli policies and who are also implicated in fomenting Islamo-hatred in this country, remember the New York mosque controversy, is the lobby led by AIPAC, but whose less savory work is carried out by its allies, paid and unpaid. AIPAC confines itself to keeping the President and Congress in line by the selective use of campaign contributions. The dirty work is done by others. Now, I want to get into the campaign contributions piece, but this episode in which editor of the New York Times called you and threatened to destroy your career, is that sort of an example of how the dirty work might get carried out?
Oh, absolutely. When you watch the news, you watch CNN, and you can see how, I particularly noticed Jake Tapper. He just recites the Israel line and challenges every person who challenges it. Now, he's not on their payroll or anything. He's just doing the work of a Israel agent of influence. It's not nefarious. There's no meeting of Jews somewhere with it. It's just, this is what he's Jewish, this is what he believes, and he's going to push back against anyone who disagrees. How bad is it? It's so bad. Because I worked on the Hill, Capitol Hill, so much, people come to me and ask about jobs up there. They're right out of college, and they'll show me what they wrote in college and things like that. This has happened dozens and dozens of times. If there's anything that they've ever written or done that's criticizing Israel, I say, get that off. You'll never get a job on Capitol Hill. They clear AIPAC, not Israel. AIPAC clears, and this particularly applies to Democrats, which I can go into later, less so Republicans. Democrats will call up and say, I've got this young person here who wants to work on Israel issues. Do you know anything about them? And they'll call back and say, they're fine. They're not fine. This one's trouble. And the person won't get hired. The reason I say it doesn't apply to Republicans is Democrats don't really believe the Israel line. Left unpressured by the money and the whole thing, they would be traditional Democrats and support human rights over Israel. or over Israel's transgressions. The Republicans are just in their pocket. They don't have to. I mean, they give money to them too, just because they like Republicans. But Republicans, there's no Republican is battling over the moral implications. They just, you know, in general, historically, in general, they're just Islamophobic and pro-war. So I'm talking about Democrats. Not that Democrats are worse. Republicans are worse, but Democrats are the ones who sort of push this issue. They have many members of Congress that are just their enforcers on the floor. In other words, like a guy like Cory Booker from New Jersey. He is so close to them. He has been an AIPAC kind of guy since he got there. And even when he was at Oxford, he was president of the Jewish Student Union, even though he's not Jewish. Everyone knows if Cory Booker is voting against it, vote against it. In the House, it was always Steny Hoyer. The new speaker, the Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, total AIPAC. If the Democrats take over, he'll be the speaker, and he'll be even more powerful. Interestingly enough, the two I named happen to be African-American Christians, but they're both supported by AIPAC and AIPAC money. So it's not a religious thing, though Jewish members tend to be the most aggressive.
So I wanted to, return to something you said a few minutes ago when Senator Levin led that letter, the letter of 30, as you called it. The phones rang off the hook. The donors were contacted. Now, reading some of your other pieces, I understand that AIPAC has historically operated a sort of an informal or formal network of donors and influenced how these donors contribute in congressional elections. Can you tell us a little bit more about how AIPAC uses campaign donations to shift congressional policy towards a pro-Israel stance?
Well, what they're doing, you have to distinguish between what they were like in the old days. The old days being before maybe 2 or 3 years ago. They used to say, it wasn't true, that they weren't involved at all. We are not a PAC, a political action committee. We don't get involved with politics. We work with the Congress that is elected. Never, that wasn't true. They publicly didn't solicit money. 2 years ago, they changed and they set up their own PAC, the AIPAC PAC. And it has raised it did it 2 years ago for the first time, tens of millions of dollars. I think this year they're planning $100 million. I think I read that in the Times. Yeah, $100 million to defeat people, elect people that they think are going to toe the line and defeat people who aren't. This year they're particularly going after every member of what they call the
squad.
Yeah. Give an example of how it works. 2 years ago, when they first started this, the Pittsburgh congressman was retiring. The person who was the front runner to replace him was an African-American woman named Summer Lee, who was in the state Senate. She was the obvious person. AIPAC met with her I have to say, every member of Congress has to fill out a questionnaire. Has to, from AIPAC, saying what their views are on Israel. They use that, they use that to determine how the person's going to vote. Summer Lee's answers were not good. She did not say check the Israel box on everything. She was just kind of, she's running for Congress. She's for peace. She said she was pro-Israel. She is pro-Israel in the sense of she wants Israel to exist. She wants it to exist in security. But she also expressed sympathy for the Palestinians and had a Palestinian working for her too. I think a Palestinian, maybe just a Muslim. They noticed all these things. So they found a Jewish lawyer in Pittsburgh to run against her in the primary. And they spent more money on that primary than spent on any primary race against a Democrat primary that year. And she only won. Oh, he was unknown, totally unknown. She was the state senator. She won barely. They flooded Pittsburgh area with ads against Summer Lee. None of them mentioned Israel. They found all these other things to talk about. Summer Lee won't stand up for Social Security the way this other guy will. I mean, all this stuff. So you'd never know unless you knew that the people running the ads are only concerned about Israel. But they knew that wouldn't fly. So they never, but you know, they never mentioned Israel. They just were called, like, you know, Committee for Good Government. Oh, whenever they get involved, they always have an anodyne name like that. You know, Committee for Corn, if they're doing it in Iowa. I mean, that's, and it's all.
So this is a new tactic. Before, it was kind of more limited to a candidate's stance on Israel, and the attack would be based on that stance. But now candidates, especially Democrats, are being attacked based on other issues, even though the motive is to enforce kind of a pro-Israel.
No, that's not it. What I meant is, previously, they didn't do anything publicly.
Okay, yeah.
Previously, it was all private. It was all on the phone.
Right.
You needed to get $5,000 to get to this. Actually, that I witnessed. Actually, I shared an office with a guy who was making those phone calls. You got to get money to this one. But it was all done privately. It was all done. Their network was huge, but the public didn't see anything.
Right.
It was just all of a sudden the guy who was running, an unknown who was running for Congress, House or Senate, would all of a sudden be receiving tons of money that he and his staff know come because he promised that he would be in AIPAC's pocket. The alternative is the person who said the wrong thing would be he would see his campaign being defunded. Now it's open, so there are ads. In other words, before 2 years ago, they weren't paying for ads. Now they're paying for ads, but they just cover up what the ads are all about because they know they can't say in an ad, do you want a senator who works for America or who works for Israel? Right. I mean, they're not going to say that. So, that's what they want.
And a lot of this money that's being used to buy ads to influence Democratic primaries is actually being donated by Republican donors. Is that correct?
Yes. The Republican donors don't, if they're involved with AIPAC, Republican quote principles don't mean that much to them on other issues. All they care about is the one who's best for on Israel, which means never pressuring Israel. I think when I say good on Israel, bad on Israel, the key point is what they consider bad is ever supporting pressure on Israel by a U.S. president to do anything. In other words, it's not that there are no resolutions in Congress that just flat out, we love Israel or we hate Israel, whatever. No, it's all like the main issue for them is don't pressure Israel. And that is the reason Biden has been so hesitant during this Gaza thing. He knows, even though the Jewish community will not vote for Trump no matter what he does, these, as Bernie Sanders likes to say, millionaires and billionaires who give the money, they will just withhold money from Biden if he pressures Israel. So anyway, I mentioned earlier that the Jewish guy running against Summer Lee lost. And a guy from AIPAC told me, well, we learned our lesson from that. We're not running Jewish guys against, we're going to find African Americans to run. So, and they have. I think there are three or four cases, you can look it up, that they did, where African American people in the community.
Well, Richie Torres is a great example, I think, in New York City. I'm not sure he was recruited, but he's very pro-Israel.
Who was that?
Richie Torres.
Oh, yeah. He is a tool of AI. Yeah. Yeah. He was recruited to do that. There was a woman, there was a Bernie Sanders aide who was running in Ohio.
Nina Turner.
Yes. They found a good liberal African-American woman, but who committed herself that she would always be with AIPAC.
Right.
And she got tons of money and a safe congressional seat.
So you've written that, I mean, AIPAC used to sort of, and perhaps still does sort of say, it organizes Americans for Israel. You've written that it actually should be registered as an agent of the Israeli government. Now, AIPAC has many American Jews in the organization. It also has evangelical Christians and others. And how representative is AIPAC of the American Jewish community and their views on Israel-Palestine?
Well, first of all, I'm going to allude to the Christian right, and which supports Israel. There, people like to say, oh, the real lobby is the Christian right, because there are 40 million, I don't want to use fundamentalists, because that's not the issue. It's right wing. It's the right, not necessarily fundamentalists. 40 million of them, and they're more important than the Jews. Well, there are more of them, but they don't vote on that issue, nor do they give money. So mainly we're talking about the Jewish community. They're just a theoretical, the Christian right wingers are much more concerned about abortion or anti-gay, that kind of stuff. The American Jewish community is much, AIPAC is mainly is now mostly Republican, its membership. However, as you can see by during this war, the American Jewish community is divided on the war, but I don't. It's not like one would think that the 80%, 75 to 80% of American Jews who vote Democratic in every election, particularly every presidential election, would all be against this war. Because if you're a liberal, but they're not, I would say it's probably split, probably 50-50. But in the old days, before Israel has discredited itself in so many ways, it would have probably been 80-20. It's Israel is losing support in the American Jewish community, and it's lost the kids.
MJ Rosenberg, a writer and commentator, former Capitol Hill staffer, and former AIPAC employee. MJ currently writes a Substack newsletter at www.mjx847.substack.com.
And it's free. I'll never ask you for money.
Yeah. All right. MJ, Jake, thanks so much for joining the show today.
Sure.